with Disabilities Committee will come to order.
As will the House Subcommittee on Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Okay. Welcome on this beautiful, almost spring morning, almost. The flowers will be outstanding when they come out with all of this weather, right? And the blossoms and so on. We're going to take a minute to introduce ourselves. This is a joint committee, and so I'll start to my far right, to the far, far right, and for introductions, please.
What?
You're going to... Tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which is portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Senator Cruz.
I'm Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is portions of Douglas, Josephine, Jackson, Curry, and all of, and Coos counties. And the president and I were just talking about the great showing that his home state... University West, by God, Virginia did in the bowl game. So,
did he talk about Carroll College that his son attends in Helena, Montana, which I also attended, that won a national football championship for the fifth or sixth or seventh time and was on the cover of Sports Illustrated recently? Did he talk about that?
Mr. Chair, you banged the gavel before we had a chance to get
okay.
there.
Okay. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, which is part of Lane County, Linn County. It's a rural urban district. And we have the House side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jean Cowan from District 10. I represent the Central Oregon Coast, Lincoln County, Northern Lane County, pieces of Polk, Yamhill, and a little tiny piece of Tillamook County. And I don't get into football discussions. I just support all high school athletics, and I also don't run marathons, so don't talk about marathons either.
I'm glad to get that out of the way.
Yeah, just want to settle that.
Now, Ron Maurer, House District 3, which is entirely in Josephine County, Grants Pass, Wonder, Selma, and Cave Junction.
Good. Thank you. No athletic comments.
In a former life, I was an NCAA compliance coordinator, and so we'll probably find a way to...
You investigate programs run awry, right?
Well, no, I tried to keep a school out of trouble.
Oh, okay. Good.
I'm Sarah Gelser, representative from District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. We have the world champion Beaver baseball team, and the Beavers, of course, did beat the Ducks.
Well, we move on to the subject at hand.
I made the comment to one of our esteemed senators that represents Corvallis after the Beavers won the World Series, and I said kind of offhandedly, well, think of what the Ducks could do if they had a baseball team. And I had no idea that the Ducks were going to try to emulate the Beavers in baseball, but it'll be interesting. Yes.
And, Senator, there's a little-known fact. I have a brother-in-law who is a coach for Western Oregon basketball, assistant coach. And he's told me that we have a esteemed colleague on this panel that is an announcer for Western Oregon, and that would be our Senate President. Mr. Peter Courtney, who does a fabulous job and is very entertaining at those events.
I'm sure of that.
He may not show up again to this meeting if we keep this up.
I do think it should be noted that I don't know everyone here. Jeff Cruz shared with me that he was a near All-American free safety for Willamette football team, and since you're talking about Carroll College, which has won five national championships in the last 6 years in their division of football, that Bill Morissette was an outstanding football player for the Carroll College football team years ago. So there are legitimate natural-born athletes on this committee. I'm not one of them, but there are very legitimate.
Now, he has a marathon tie on, and on that tie, there are figures on it, and he is on that tie, actually.
It's in the knot somewhere. I know that some people think we're not going to get to our business today, but...
Okay. What we're dealing with in our committee today is a bill that has been worked on actually since the end of the last session by a group of stakeholders. And it's the goal, I think, of our group of stakeholders in our committee to institutionalize, so to speak, the long-term care system, which we feel is somewhat fragmented. And the bill that we have that we'll get to later in the morning after our first presentation deals with the crisis in long-term care for seniors and paying for the nursing home population, which is fairly expensive, but also looking at all of the ways that we keep people out of nursing homes. And so it's a huge issue, and with the baby boomer tsunami, so to speak, we really have to take some time to investigate our delivery system. And because all healthcare is delivered locally, we will be looking at the local delivery systems as well, and that's what we're hoping that we will accomplish during the February and carrying over to 09, because most of the solutions will come in the 09 session. During our last meeting, Meredith Cody was here, and she left the presentation that she made, which I thought was wonderful, and we didn't have time to go to get do it, you know, to get through that at the last time. And so this is the quality in long-term care residential, and she is a long-term care ombudsman. And so, Meredith, would you please come up and talk about what your office is doing, which I think is extremely important. So if you would introduce yourself, please.
Chair Morissette, Chair Cowan, members of the committees, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the state long-term care ombudsman, and I've been in that position for 18 years now, so I've got a bit of a perspective on our long-term care system. Last time that you met, I developed a presentation on quality, and I gave you, I think, the five-minute version, and I've been asked to come back today and give you a somewhat longer version of that testimony. And for those of you that are not familiar with the work of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, in a nutshell, we're an agency of small central Salem staff, and we recruit, train, and certify volunteers to be a regular presence in long-term care facilities throughout the state. And so we are volunteer-based, and the uniqueness of our program is that we have absolutely no conflict of interest with the resident, and we have been developed as an agency both by federal law and state law to focus on the needs and the preferences of the residents. And we also serve as a check and balance to other government involvement with long-term care facility residents, and we do have an overall charge to monitor the long-term care system. So in essence, we have volunteers that hit the road every day and are in facilities. They're working with residents. They respond to those residents. Their phone numbers are posted in the facilities. They receive calls in their homes. There are times when they're in the facilities on nights and on weekends. And so they actually allow the state of Oregon to provide a service for people that is outside of the routine 8-to-5 that is provided by many state agencies. The other element is that it's a rather intense service because, and I couldn't foresee that we'd ever be able to provide that service without the remarkable contribution of volunteers throughout the state, because we have to have people in the facilities. The whole objective is to earn the trust of the residents so the residents feel comfortable disclosing issues and problems that they're facing. And so that's how we operate as an agency, and that's how the perspective that we have. And we report to the federal government.
I'm sorry, Meredith, you have some additional materials to hand out. We have some just for the dais, but if you have some to hand out to Aaron, that would be helpful. Thank you.
And so the agency handles about 4,000 resident complaints a year. We also do a lot of consultations with people in the long-term care system. And interestingly, a lot of people and an increasing number of people seeking information on long-term care facilities. So we do a lot of that where people call us and they want information. They want to know what the complaints are about a facility. They want to know what the recent survey or licensing inspection report says about that facility. So we actually have staff that go through the files with people in order for those people to make the decisions about the care of a loved one. So that's what the office does. And from that perspective, and working with residents day in and day out, I thought it was helpful in terms of presenting something to you to draw on perhaps some other sources to talk about quality in long-term care. And that's why the testimony looks at two different groups that have been studying quality in long-term care that are external to Oregon, and that is the Institute of Medicine that did a big report on quality in long-term care that I think was issued around 2001. And then there's a big bipartisan commission at the national level that is looking at quality in long-term care, and they actually commissioned academics and researchers to do studies for them. And so what I have provided you is some information from those studies to help give some perspective to what quality is. But essentially, in the issue of quality in long-term care, and I don't think that it can be underestimated, is that when we talk about quality, we have to talk about two things, and that's quality of care and quality of life. And there are ways to measure quality of care, and the federal government does it in nursing homes. We look at pressure ulcers, we look at dehydration, we look at all of those things. But equally important to the residents of long-term care facilities, and the ombudsman know this all too well, is our quality of life kinds of things. I mean, this is their home now. So they're really interested in things like meaningful activities. And some people, privacy is very important. Having meals that they like. You know, many of these people having their meals every day is a source, something that they look forward to, and having meals and food in the facilities that they like. And what another thing that can't be overestimated is the contribution that staff make to that quality of life in a long-term care facility. Having staff who are friendly, who are patient, who take the time to assist residents, to take the time to help residents be more independent, which sometimes may take more time than assisting the residents. But all of those things contribute to what is the quality experience in a long-term care facility. And I think that many times our rules and how we proceed and look at long-term care facilities, we give short shrift to the quality of life elements. And really, they're both equally important in a long-term care situation. The other key element, and that's assumed prominence lately, is this: there's a notion out there called person-centered care. And it's part of a big movement in long-term care right now called culture change. And it was identified by the Institute of Medicine in 2001. And in the testimony on page 5, I quote from the committee because their comment was, the committee believes that long-term care should be consumer-centered, focusing on the needs, circumstances, and preferences of people using care and involving them to the extent possible in planning, delivering, and evaluating care. And so what this gets to the notion is a lot of long-term care can be facility-centered. It's about tasks. It's about routines. It's about doing things for residents. And what this is a shift, this cultural change movement is a shift to focus back on the residents. And at the last informational meeting that you had, or the first one on this issue, I think that the provider community talked about several examples where they are trying to implement in some facilities culture change because the providers themselves recognize that this is where long-term care needs to be. One of the things that the Institute of Medicine added when they talked about this person-centered care is that they said that an adequate supply of caregivers who are appropriately trained and sensitive to provide such care is a prerequisite to person-centered care. And at the essence of that is the notion in long-term care facilities of what we call consistent staffing. That is, the same staff care for the same residents so that those relationships are formed, so that the those staff get to know the residents and there is a bond that forms there. And so when we look at whether it be rules or our initiatives in long-term care, it's really, really important to look at where the state is going in trying to achieve these goals, which have been generally recognized by both the federal government. In fact, the Centers for Medicare Services is actually has integrated some of the culture change principles in some of the work that they're doing with nursing homes through some of the what used to be peer review organizations in Oregon, now is called Acumentra Health, that work through contract with the federal government with nursing homes to try to implement some of these principles. So we do have some of this happening and taking place in Oregon, not on any wide scale, in any wide scale manner, but we do have some of this going on. And I thought one of the things that was interesting in one of the papers that the RTI paper that was produced for the Bipartisan Commission on Quality Long-Term Care is they Josh Weiner in his paper, and Josh Weiner has been researching long-term care for as long as I can remember. He's been with the Urban Institute, and now he's with RTI, but he did this comprehensive paper on sort of where we are now in quality. And he took all of the initiatives in quality, and he sort of broke them down into categories. And I think that if you look at them, you can sort of place some of the initiatives that you've heard from others in the advocacy community and the regulatory agency. But on page 6 of the testimonies, I sort of break them out in terms of there are the approaches to improving quality. There are mandatory approaches that are external to providers, and those are things like strengthening the regulatory process and strengthening the caregiver workforce. Then there are voluntary approaches that are external to providers, like providing consumers with more information about the quality of services provided, strengthening consumer advocacy, and then changing the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement systems, including the systems of incentives they generate. And I know that's something that the committee is going to be looking at in the coming years. And then there are voluntary strategies that are internal to providers, and those are some of the ones that the provider community discussed with you last time, which are developing and implementing practice guidelines and changing the organizational culture of long-term care providers. And so I would say that at this time in Oregon, we're dabbling in all of those areas, and we have initiatives in all of those areas. And I think that we've been more successful in some areas than in others. And I guess I'd like to spend some time just sort of commenting on some of the things, some of the quality approaches that we have going in long-term care, and from the perspective of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, what our concerns or observations are with respect to those. One of the things that we have been very, very concerned about, and I think that the Department of Human Services has, in their budget hearing they talked about it, and I think they've been very forthcoming with legislators, is the fact that with respect to assisted living facilities and residential care facilities, the state only inspects those facilities. Their guideline is every 2 years, and as recently as the fall of 2006, a third of those facilities, they were approaching three-year intervals between licensing inspections. And that, from the perspective of the Ombudsman, is absolutely unacceptable. And I know that the department came to the legislature and got increased the number of people doing those inspections in order to decrease that interval. But even with the best approach, that interval is the department aspires to doing inspections only every 2 years. And I would posit that that's probably not sufficient enough. There's just too much turnover in these facilities. There's too many things that can go wrong, and it would seem that a time frame such as with nursing homes that are inspected within a 15-month period would be a more appropriate inspection interval here in Oregon for those facilities. And I might also add that adult foster care homes are inspected annually. And so that's really important, because that inspection is only a snapshot in time, but those inspectors look at things that other people in the system just don't routinely look at. They do a very, very comprehensive look at records, which is just not something that is usually looked at by ombudsmen or even adult protective services workers outside of the specific issue they're investigating.
Now, could you tell us a little bit more about who the inspectors are and how they're trained and what role the ombudsman play? Because I was going to ask the question, are they ombudsmen? Well, you just said they're not.
No. The licensing inspections are conducted by seniors and people with disabilities, and they have a unit called the Client Care Monitoring Unit. And that unit inspects nursing homes, and they have there's a federal-state partnership for the inspection of nursing homes. With respect to assisted living and residential care, it is completely a state initiative, and so it's conducted by that same unit. On the other hand, foster care homes are licensed and inspected locally by the local area agencies on aging or the local office of seniors and people with disabilities. So I guess the advocacy that we have here is that even in the best of circumstances, that a two-year interval just does not seem to be sufficient. And over the years, I've looked at the inspections of residential care, and there was a period in the early 1990s where the state was actually 7 years behind in the interval with residential care facilities. And so there have been big efforts by the state, and I do believe that they are making efforts with the resources that they have to close those gaps. But it's still a significant gap. The other issue is that recently, after many years of work, the rules for assisted living and residential care facilities have been revised. But the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman still is concerned about two issues in particular, and that is staff training and numbers of staff. The standards in those rules indicate that facilities are to staff to resident need, but it's very, very hard for anybody to get a handle on what that means or to hold facilities accountable for that standard. And many facilities don't have the sophistication to do what's called an acuity-based staffing standard. standard. And so we do have instances where facilities are just not staffing appropriately. And if you reflect back on Lauren Kessler's comments before this committee when you last met, she indicated that she was in a memory care unit in Eugene, and she was taken care of between 11 and 14 residents. And in a memory care unit, the assumption is that there are going to be more staff rather than fewer staff. And so what she was saying was that they were that the staff had to pursue their tasks at breakneck speed in order to meet all the demands for them, and that there were things that they just simply couldn't do. And those are the kinds of results that one gets when you leave staffing completely to the facility to determine what is appropriate, because there's lots of things that affect how a facility determines its staffing. And that can be budget driven, that can be availability driven, but the upshot is that when facilities aren't staffed appropriately, it doesn't work well for the people who are trying to provide the care, and it certainly doesn't work well for the residents. The other issue that we're really concerned about is staff training.
Now, let me just take a minute to have you, for the record, talk about the structure of WE, your department. You're under the governor's office, right?
Chair Morsat, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman is in the executive branch of government, so we are all under the governor's office.
But we explain the checks and the checks and balances that exist with your agency in relationship to the people that you are inspecting, to DHS, for instance. What authority do you have? What freedom do you have to air the grievances and actually be the true advocates of the clients that we're dealing with? That's important to
the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. The legislature made the office separate and independent from any other state agency, and that was because it was very apparent that it was a conflict of interest for the agency to be in the Department of Human Services or any agency that licenses or inspects long-term care facilities or certifies people for Medicaid eligibility, because those are all of those issues are issues that could affect residents. And so the independence of an ombudsman program is essential. That, as I indicated earlier, being free of conflict of interest is very, very important for the office's ability to be able to carry out its function with respect to residents. And so that is why, under both federal and state law, the office not only does complaint investigations, non-abuse complaint investigations, because those are handled by Adult Protective Services, but we also have that monitoring function. And the other function is the one that, as I sit here before you today, that is one of the functions of the ombudsman, to talk to legislators from the perspective of the ombudsman's office and its independence in the system, what the agency sees as some of the issues and problems in the system. And I do think that staff training, particularly in community-based care, which is assisted living, residential care, and adult foster homes, is a significant issue. There's just not enough of it. And going back to Lauren Kessler's experience, she talked about her training, and I think she used the term before you, as laughable. And that's really, really unfortunate, because she was in a memory care unit that carried an endorsement for the state to care for some of our most impaired clients, people with Alzheimer's and other dementia. And with an endorsement, there is a responsibility to train that comes with that endorsement. But yet she talked to you about her training and that experience in some detail and called it laughable. And we really support In the nursing home arena, there is a mandated training for certified nurses assistants, and then you have the licensed personnel. And our agency really supports the notion of having some kind of mandated curriculum that is taught by people who are approved trainers. One of the things that you have with the new the training standards as they are in the rules is that they are in fact required facilities to train on certain subjects, identified subjects in the rules, and the caregiver is supposed to demonstrate some competence. But there's a wide variation on how any particular facility interprets that training responsibility in terms of how comprehensive it should be. And there is nothing that assures us that the person training has the requisite knowledge to be able to be training people. And so I looked briefly at the state of Washington, for example, and they have a mandated curriculum for which is clearly not as intense as you would have for a certified nursing assistant. But it's designed to provide the basic competencies to provide care in a community-based setting. And they actually have approved trainers for that training.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The question then gets back to a workforce issue. Do you believe that there are enough people in the system to be the trainers? Because you can create a system, but I mean, we talk about workforce, and then you could create a system that's unsustainable because you don't have the people to train. And I'm not disagreeing with the training need, but are there, we are in the 21st century, and we need to look at different modalities for training these people, and are there alternatives in different states? You know, I hate to use the word internet, but there are new modalities that may be very beneficial that are going to be cost effective. The state can have substantial control over those topics and the content of that curriculum. And are there other states besides Washington that are doing it and may be doing it well?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I absolutely agree with your point, and I think that there may be other states that we can look to. Certainly, we've demonstrated some ingenuity over the years, but the point I'm trying to make is I think that we do have to be creative in this training, and we have to look for ways to better ensure that this workforce is trained. We also have significant workforce issues, and we have a huge turnover in this industry, and the industry itself spends millions and millions on turnover because it's very expensive. Turnover is very, very expensive. So part of even the whole notion of culture change is to create invest more in that workforce from the standpoint of empowering them to minimize that turnover. And actually it's shown there is evidence out there that that has happened. So I guess getting back to it, yes, I do think that with anything, you always have to be cognizant that there may be shortages or there may be that we may not have the trainers. But I do think that we should be aspiring to something more than we have now, and we should be looking to more. And the use of technology to train, that may be a wonderful area where we can explore that, bring more people on board, but make sure that they have the skills. And so I'm not opposed to that anyway. I just think that we need to be doing more, and we need to think about it in a way and not be complacent with what we're doing.
One follow-up. And do you believe that the issue of the training falls under Section 3 of the of LC-28, that is part of that discussion?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I've only read LC-28. I read it through it briefly, but I didn't get the sense that I guess I didn't get the sense necessarily that that was what that was looking at, and it may be I was not involved in the drafting of it, so I don't know what the intent of the people who brought it together was. But I do. I guess the salient piece is I just think that the state has to become more of a partner in identifying what that training needs to be and ensuring that it happens. And right now, it's left to the facilities, each individual facility, to decide how best to train its employees. And I guess what I'm saying is I don't believe that that's working for the residents.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap this up pretty soon. But what I, the reason that I want you to be totally involved with what we're attempting to do is because you're an integral part. You're an independent agency. In fact, I had a bill last time that enhanced your power to get information on demand, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Not that it wasn't always there, but this is to
and
make...
And I hardly ever demand.
Well, to make it absolutely clear that you are an independent agency, and if you need information from the agency, they have to give it to you immediately, and so on and so forth. Now, having said that, I would like you to work with the agency, with Human Services in your area, and work with our committee on an ongoing basis. And if you have some suggestions on how to improve the system, because we, the legislature, is the oversight, right? And you're to report to the legislature. I think we have to connect, you know, that circle and work together to improve. Now, that is not saying that the agency isn't doing everything they possibly can to fulfill the obligation. That's not saying they're not doing that. However, I think that we need your insight on an ongoing basis, and so we can talk to the AAA also about what they're doing at the local level. And I guess that raises the question of funding of the Ombudsman program at the local level, making sure that there are enough people out there to do the work. So that's what I would like us to do. The training issue, I think that Representative Maurer raised is interesting. You know, let's look at the different ways of training. Representative Gelser.
Yes, I just had a question about the structure. Do adults with developmental disabilities in the state's residential care and non-relative adult foster care programs have access to the services of the Ombudsman's Office?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, no, they do not.
Follow-up?
Yes.
How come?
Well, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman is a creature of the Federal Older Americans Act, which was specifically designed for older Americans. And so as the program was then implemented in the state, it specifically addresses the residents of nursing homes and board and care homes that are older. And so the way that that got interpreted here in the state of Oregon is that that would be facilities licensed by seniors and people with disabilities, focusing on people, facilities that had older residents.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Is there a similar protection for people with developmental disabilities in the system who are also in programs licensed by seniors and people with disabilities, or are they just kind of on their own to navigate the system without an advocate?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, as I understand, we are the only ombudsman program that provides the kind of service that we do, which is reaching out to the actual client and trying to work with them and work through their problems.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In closing, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would just like to say I have enormous respect for the efforts particularly in recent years, by seniors and people with disabilities. I really believe that, although I think it was slow in coming, I think that they've really gotten on board with the notion of quality and are using their resources in a way to maximize their abilities to ensure quality. And I do think that there are elements of the provider community, particularly the associations that represent them, that are really taking this issue seriously. But I do believe that I think that there are areas of the system that need a little bit more nudging than what seems to be naturally occurring at this time. And I guess I'll just close with that.
Okay. It's possible to create an ombudsman program to deal with the developmentally disabled legislatively. That, I think, is a possibility.
Mr. Chair, I think it's possible, and to the extent that one could draw down Medicaid money to help fund that in the way that we do for the long-term care ombudsman, I think that would make it a more feasible for the state.
Well, we're trying to draw down Medicaid money to deal with arms movement for Medicaid, for the Oregon Health Plan, which the feds say we're supposed to be doing, but we're not. So that's our number one project, to add to the Ombudsman program, to be truly advocates for their clients. Because now if a person calls in with a question about Oregon Health Plan, they may get one of three answers. They may get someone who gives them information. They may get someone who says, oh, by the way, we can help you check here, or they may get someone who will say, hey, I will take the time to walk you through the program and I will make sure you get what you need. We don't necessarily have that component in that program. So that's a Medicaid ombudsman that we're looking at also. But it doesn't preclude what you're talking about. If we have some adequate funding, we can work on that. And funding, I think, is the problem now. I mean, no one disagrees that we should be doing these. It's just a matter of funding.
And Mr. Chair, I think that I hope that's something that we can explore in the future. If you look at the differences in the needs of the population, the folks that are able to actually become eligible for services in the adult developmental disability system are those who by nature are already in crisis. Their natural supports have fallen away. Their parents have died, so can no longer take care of them at home like they have for their entire adult lives, often until they themselves need to go into assisted living. So there are so few eyes on these individuals in the system, and it's a little bit alarming that we leave them without any advocates to come to the legislature to talk about issues like abuse and neglect and civil penalties and training and adequate staffing. So I really do think that's something we need to look at as a priority of this legislative body. It's not a very powerful group. They don't have big lobby groups, but I think that we need to do a better job of addressing their needs.
Thank you. Representative Maurer?
The question, and that is it reasonable or unreasonable to look at it as a part of your program, because I believe there probably is some overlap, or is it so dissimilar that you want to create a separate ombudsman? Your opinion.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I guess that's the $50,000 question.
or more.
I think what's happened in the state and what we've experienced over the years is that there are communities that do not have advocates, and there are problems in the systems that advocates could have identified if they had been there, such that the system wouldn't have gotten to the point that it is. And I think we, in the past, there are people with mental illness, I know, that they have looked at the ombudsman. People right now in the Oregon Health Plan Managed Care have looked for an ombudsman, and we have been approached. Our office, you know, one of the things that I've always said is I'm not in any way an empire builder, and I think that it would be something that would need to be discussed. And, I don't think that it's not doable. I just think that it's just something that we'd have to look at. There are financing issues. There are Older Americans Act money issues that have to remain separate and distinct. And I think it would just have to be some discussion about what that would do. What I fear the most, Representative Maurer, is that our agency has operated with the smallest staff of any long-term care ombudsman program in the country for years. What I fear is that we will have all these other responsibilities and we will still stay at a level that we're just struggling, you know, to meet our core mandate. And so I worry about that, taking so much on and not having the resources attached to that.
We've had that discussion. And I think that it would, the ideal situation would be to expand the existing office and put it, you know, within Meredith's domain, but to give her the staff to do it so she doesn't have to take things away from what she's already doing, and that's the problem. So,
that's fine.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, before we get into our LC 28, Representative Cowan, would you like to make some comments?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to be moving into a public hearing on LC 28, and I just would like to make a few introductory comments about it. First of all, I want to say that I really appreciate the fact that this has been almost an unprecedented joint effort, not just in the legislative body itself, but the fact that we are sitting together here, representatives of the Senate and the House of Representatives. I think that's important that we are jointly talking about this. Also, the fact that so many people in the, for lack of a better term, the generic advocacy community came together and in an effort to try to bring some thoughts around our current and what I consider a pending crisis in the long-term care system, and that's what LC 28 has developed into. And I would have to say that this bill is unique, and I've had a number of people come to me and tell me that they haven't seen anything quite like it before, and I understand that. It tries to, they said, you're throwing a whole bunch of stuff into this, a whole bunch of issues, and that is, in fact, the case. The goal in this bill is twofold. The first is to try to address an immediate, urgent need, and hence the fact that it can get into the 08 session, which is one of the guidelines for the session, is that is there something of a degree of urgency that it needs to be addressed right away. And we do see that in the loss of capacity that we're seeing steadily developed for the Medicaid population in long-term care, substitute home, mid-level homes, whatever you want to call that sort of generic residential care, assisted living, adult foster care for the senior and people with physical disabilities population. It was really brought home to me sort of between the eyes during the last session when one of the assisted living facilities in my community decided to no longer accept Medicaid clients on a 60-day notice basis, and I had 15 individuals in a rural community that we had a very difficult time finding placement for, not to mention the unfairness of the way the whole situation was addressed. So we're also seeing a number of facilities who are looking at graduate withdrawal contracts to move out of the Medicaid market. And this market is unique because it's a combination of private pay and Medicaid individuals. And so the challenges facing it are very different than many of the other systems that we work with. That's the reason for the piece in the opening portions of the bill that talk about a sort of a Band-Aid intermediate rate increase to try to forestall some of that loss of capacity. But secondly, I think that it's important to remember that the goal of this bill is also to open a much bigger conversation about the system as a whole, or as I just heard, I like that term, nudge the system. we need to try to prioritize the pieces of the puzzle and to come to together in 09 and beyond. I don't look at this as a one-year or a two-year effort to try to do to highlight some comprehensive planning that's already started and to look at the whole breadth of issues within the system that really do need to be addressed. Oregon has had an exemplary community-based care system, and I find that when I travel to other states, anytime I happen, business happens to take me somewhere else, I try to sit down with the senior community in that state to sort of find out how they're doing things, and what ends up happening is they say, yeah, but you're from Oregon, tell us about how you're doing all this cool stuff, and I am proud of what we have, but we see that it's crumbling. It's nearly broken. We have got to fix the Medicaid piece and address that diminishing capacity. We have to pay attention to the boomer demographic and the growing number of people that are going to be accessing this system in a very short time. The bill attempts to look at pre-Medicaid supports to help folks from moving into that next step of need, and AAA funding formulas, Area Agencies on Aging, and I think this is a room that understands most of these letters, as well as quality assurance, and I like the concept of the community, the consumer-based. Certainly it does mention workforce issues, and specifically Section 3, Number 7, talks about training capacity in order to help with the recruitment and retention of qualified workers in the field. So it is not intended to have covered everything, but to try to open a discussion about what we need to talk about. I really do think that we are at a tipping point, and we need a complete strategic effort to come together, and I emphasize that, to come together to accomplish the goals that that we're trying to address. And yeah, my primary goal is to call attention to the issue and to launch that conversation. I would certainly hope that we begin to be able to have it on a national basis as well. And then I just wanted to mention that I anticipate that we will hear today a little bit about some of the potential inadvertent impacts on other pieces of our long-term care system. And certainly those are things that, those are questions that we need to take up. I would suspect that we will probably eventually put in some amendments during the regular hearing process during session that will attempt to forestall the more grave adverse impacts, I guess, would be the way I would put it. But I think that also needs to launch us into a conversation in 09 and beyond on the other aspects of the long-term care system that were not specifically addressed in this bill, nor was this one particularly designed to do that. So I just want to sort of set the stage for the conversation and let people know that we're trying to attend to a variety of these things, but this is just a starting point for a conversation I hope will carry on for some time. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Our committee administrator is going to set the record straight here.
What did I just say that I shouldn't have?
No, I'm sorry. Set the record straight for the running of the meeting after you've made your comments.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple process issues here. For anybody in the audience and anybody listening online, we are going to be addressing LC, or Legislative Concept 28, which is dated 1708. There was an earlier draft out for some review, so make sure you are looking at the 1708 draft. When the committee is done with the public hearing, they'll be looking at going to a work session. Since technically this is a Senate legislative concept, it'll just be the senators who will be voting in a work session whether or not to introduce this for the 2008 session. This then will be go from this committee to the Senate secretary's desk, and at which point it'll be printed into a bill if it's introduced for the February 08 session. So you won't see a bill number for this until we get to the February. Upward of February 4th. That's it, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. James Taves, would you come up, please?
Good Chairman, and Madam Chair, would you just like me, I'm sorry for the record, James Tate from the Department of Human Services, would you just like to have me comment on the current draft or?
That and any other insights that you have, but I think it's important that because you have been intimately involved in the drafting of this bill and we've consulted with you, and I think we've come to an agreement with you that we're doing, you know, taking the right approach, and so it's appropriate that you give us kind of an overview and express your concerns and compelling reasons why we need to move.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we're also passing out. We've just completed, and I think some of you have seen earlier variations of, but we've tried to sort of consolidate all the issues around the crisis in the Medicaid system on the senior and physical disability side in this short little paper, which attaches a series of caseload charts, which are pretty graphic in displaying the issues in the precipitous drop in Medicaid capacity across our community-based system and the corresponding increase in nursing home caseload. So I didn't plan to go through that today, but that's just background data to better sort of fill in the discussion that we've been having for the last matter of months. LC-28, as Senator Morissette indicated, the department's worked very closely with this committee and with the other stakeholders, and we think it's an excellent bill. It codifies much of the long-range planning that we're already doing to deal with the aging demographic that we've talked about in detail in the previous committee, and we still anticipate by early to mid-summer that we will have a draft of the comprehensive plan for senior and disability services, sort of mapping out where we think this system needs to go over the next 20 to 25 years as this demographic population wave doubles in the state, and we expect our Medicaid caseloads to double during that time as well. So we will come forward at that time and work with this committee as well as all our stakeholders, and that's again codified in the language in this bill. The bill also includes in the latter sections a series of programs that we will work with the stakeholders, bring forward cost projections for those different programs. Whether or not they end up in the governor's budget is a different issue, but nonetheless, we've committed ourselves to come forward with cost projections, and that includes some of the restoration of programs that were previously reduced from the 2003 session on. So we're absolutely committed to doing that. One of the key issues around this bill, as Representative Cowan summarized very, very well, is again the crisis in the drop in Medicaid capacity and the increase in nursing home caseload trends, and the real big concern we have, not only as the system is shrinking at a time when the population is going to double, but also just the more immediate future concerns about the department's budget. If the nursing home caseload really accelerates as it appears to be doing under these current trend lines, it could cause a very significant budget hole in the department's budget. So that's why we are so intent in looking at every possible strategy to stabilize our Medicaid capacity on the community side. The department, in its rebalance plan, although all of the final decisions haven't been made, but at this point in time, we're still including about a $9.7 million general fund increase, which would result in about a $260 per month per person increase across adult foster care, assisted living, and residential care facilities on the senior and physical disability side. The draft paper here sort of describes the different methodologies and why we arrived at that. So that's still in the proposals from the department in our rebalance plan that we hope to bring forward for the February special session within the department's rebalance plan. I know there are other major concerns about how that then pushes out across other populations, including developmental disabilities, relative foster care, et cetera, because, again, we focus just where the capacity crisis is right now, but we recognize if you start messing with rates in one area, then you could have dislocation or problems in other parts of the system. And we recognize that. The department's rebalance plan and this bill in its current form doesn't address all the rate issues, the inequity issues, the fairness issues across all of our populations. It simply doesn't. And I know there are ongoing discussions about what we do with that. There are some other major task groups that are working, for example, on the developmental disability side. We have a massive rate restructuring effort going on that's involved a large federal grant, lots of task force hours, consultants we've brought in from around the country to reposition the entire rate structure of the developmental disability system, which really hasn't been updated since the closure of Fairview, and the rates are all out of whack. So we're looking at both an assessment process and how rates would be set going forward. So I guess what I want to emphasize is we're not ignoring other populations. We recognize there are very significant concerns. Our immediate concern, though, is to sort of stem the tide of the loss of Medicaid capacity for part of the population, which, again, if it pushes out into nursing home caseloads, will create such a huge problem, both in the short term and the long term for our system. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, the first question, which is very important, is whether or not this bill has a fiscal impact connected with it.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal impact, in as much as Section 1 deals with rate changes, is again, hopefully, on a parallel track with the department's rebalance plan. So I think I'm not sure technically what that means if we say, well, it's in the department's rebalance plan, but this bill on its face has X fiscal impact. So I'm not the person to answer that. All I can say is we're planning for it within the department's available dollars.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask that is because at one point, you know, you came out with a figure which you just mentioned of $9.5 or $7 million, and we inadvertently put that in the bill at one point, which kind of frightened people and said, you know, that may not fly. And so we took that out, and hopefully you have an understanding that, you know, the rebalance that you spoke of will stay within your division and not wander off somewhere to be used for other needy programs. We've tried to craft a bill that would emphasize the positive aspects of what we're trying to do without requiring additional money at this time from the Ways and Means. Now, the Ways and Means may find it in their heart to fund various programs that are related to this, but we're not. The intent of this bill is not to ask for additional funds, is what I'm saying. We have tried to avoid that with the understanding that the rebalance would serve a purpose. And if the rebalance wasn't used for that, you may have to take that money from other programs to keep people, you know, in the nursing homes if there is. Now, could you just touch briefly on the cost involved? How many people shifting to nursing homes would cost? How much money? You use those figures, and if you could just refresh our memory.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you take this little analysis that we did and you turn to page, it's after page 6, it's attachment 1.
Okay, could you just explain that, please?
And this is one of those rare instances where we printed in color because otherwise it becomes so confusing. So
thank
I just
you.
Want to make sure that we routinely do not use color printing. if you look at this, and I think what's more significant is the nursing home caseload trend when you go all the way back to 2001, and if you took it all the way back into the 90s, you'd see a steady decline in the nursing home caseloads over that entire period. If you look at the little green line with the little triangles that's at the bottom at the far right, that's where the caseload forecast was about, let me see what year that was, in fall of 05. We were trending based on all caseload forecasts that we would come in under 4,500, about 4,400 people on Medicaid in nursing homes. If you look at the little orange line, that's where the current forecast has been adjusted to, and actually we think that's even too low, and it's going to go higher than that. So when you think longer term over a multi-year period, you've got almost a 400 or 500-person swing in nursing home caseloads, and at where the rate is going to go now, based on the statutory formula and the provider tax, I think it's just gone up July 1st. I'm not sure where the rate is at now, 5,700 or 5,800 a month, and scheduled to go higher. So you take that rate times that number of people, and you can begin to see the swing in our budget towards the most expensive part of our system. And then correspondingly, if you look at attachment 2, which follows on the next page, you can see where the forecast was scheduled to go in spring of 05, which are the little red line that was trended to continue going up, and in the fall forecast it's way down. So you've got, again, a declining caseload on the community side, increasing caseload on the nursing home side.
For clarity, that CBC caseload, that's people who are in community-based care and some other mid-level setting,
correct,
is what I like to call it, instead of nursing home. Is that correct?
Correct. And then the following pages actually break it down by assisted living, foster care, residential care facilities, et cetera. So, again, I hope these charts aren't too confusing, but we were really trying to draw the picture of what the nature of the crisis is.
Now, could you attach a dollar figure to the difference in the assisted living facility and a nursing home facility? How much are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, the rates in foster care range from about, and I'm just giving approximates, I don't have a rate chart in front of me, is about $950 up to about $1,600, I think, is the range in foster care. For assisted living, I think the average is about $1,600 or $1,700.
Okay, we're talking a month.
A month.
Yeah.
In home, it's I don't even remember what the figure is. It's much, much, much lower as an average across the entire in home program. So typically, your nursing home costs are doubled, and sometimes even more than your equivalent community based rate.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't earlier catch the nursing home cost. It was approximately.
Would you come up, please?
Do you know what the monthly, that translates into the monthly?
Help us with the math, because I don't have
okay.
a calculator.
Would you
sit down? We have it right in the silver
okay. hand. And would you introduce yourself for the record, please? Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of
okay,
Care.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Geer just pointed out on page 5 of this, it has the rate history across all these different settings,
okay.
And so you can see the corresponding differences.
Okay. What I'm trying to establish is the basis for our concern. I mean, the I've worked with Kay Metzger, who's in the audience in Lane County, and we've gone through this and rates in Lane County for nursing homes, which are very well, it depends on the acuity. I mean, if you're talking Alzheimer's nursing home care, I guess 24/7, it's huge. And, you know, the bottom line is, how do we keep people in their own home? I mean, you go from the home care on one side to the nursing home care on the other, which is the least expensive sometimes to the most expensive. So that's what we're working on. Representative, did you have a question?
I do. I had a couple questions. Can I just roll with them?
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, wait a minute. Are we finished? Are they related to what we're talking about right
yes.
now?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Because I wanted to... excuse me. Could you just finish this conversation that you came up here for in terms of rates?
We've pointed you to the chart on page 5. Mm-hmm. I would also point to the last bullet on the bottom of page 2, and that's a summary of what the fiscal impact looks like when clients transfer from community-based care into nursing facilities.
That's
which
the number
is what
we're
looking
for. Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Would you please... tell us that
yes.
for the record.
So for every 100 clients who are placed in nursing facilities from community-based care, the additional cost to SPD is $4.6 million, which is $9.2 million per biennium.
And what's the projection for the rest of this biennium? Do you have one? Of people who are actually going to be transferred? Unless we do something.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, if you go back to attachment 1, that is the current forecast. If you look at the orange line, that is the current projection. And that's based on caseloads on the community side not continuing to drop even further. So our assumptions, if all our strategies, including the rate change, don't mitigate that drop, then this forecast line is going to go up much steeper. So based on this current forecast, our budget is still balanced, and within SPD's budget, we're able to move the dollars around to come up with what will be the proposed rate change. But the concern is if we don't stabilize this, and this caseload then increases dramatically more in the coming months, that we could face a significant crisis before the end of the biennium.
Okay. Now, and I guess I want to be sure that we're understanding that the rebalance would do what? If you could keep that rebalance within your division. Now, explain the rebalance. What is a rebalance? Could you explain that for the record? Well, I mean, we're using a lot of terms here that people may not really understand, and so just to close that loop.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, the department rebalances its budget several times throughout the biennium. Mm-hmm. Typically, that's done before the emergency board, where we look at all programs across the department to see where the caseloads. It's based on updated caseload forecasts across child welfare, mental health, seniors and disability programs, TANF, and all the other programs. We look at that time on changes in federal match rates or other federal policy changes that can adjust the relative match between the general fund and the federal fund portion. And all that then comes in together in a department rebalance plan that's presented to the emergency board. This situation is a little bit unique because we're going into a special session of the legislature, but what the department's bringing forward is its rebalance plan for the legislature to either approve or make adjustments to. And typically, I would say, Mr. Chairman, the department's rebalance plan is an artifact of the fact that we have a two-year budget. So we have a two-year budget based on the biennium, and much of the planning for that two-year budget starts even a year before that. So much changes within 2 to 3 years. So it's a pretty logical process that the department's budget needs to be adjusted throughout that period.
Okay, now the next step is that you've mentioned a lot of rebalance programs that are not within your division. Now, there are within the Department of Human Services, there are a number of divisions. Each division will have TANF, for instance, is not in your division.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So, within your division, you anticipate saving of $9 million, that if you could keep that, would then go toward the rates that we pay. Is this
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, that in the department's rebalance plan within the SPD budget itself, yes, in terms of savings and revenue sources, we've balanced and we have that amount that we've identified as a proposal for this particular rate increase. That's correct.
So that's just to be clear that we're not talking about saving some TANF and all of these other programs, which they will have their own rebalance and so on and so forth. We're concerned with your rebalance staying within your department.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me be clear. The rebalance plan is the department's rebalance plan. Each of the divisions bring forward both their problems and their savings, and ultimately that rolls up at a department level across.
Well, as Representative Gelser has mentioned several times, that your division has been a donor division. Oftentimes, that money was taken from your division and given to other divisions, and we want to not have that happen, right? Now, leading, go ahead. And
thank you for teeing me up, Mr. Chair. So within the $9.7 million within the SPD department, I mean, even within SPD, you've got your senior and physical disabled side and your DD side. How much of that is coming from your developmental disability side? What kinds of savings are you seeing in your DD program?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Representative Gelser, I'd have to net it all out, but I don't believe any of this is coming from the DD side. We have problems and savings on the DD side as well that we'll have in the rebalance, but again, at least at this point in time, the drop on the community side has been more than enough to net out the savings that we can apply to this rate increase, and they're pretty sizable across the community-based system on the senior and physical disability side. I will double-check, but I don't think there's any shifting between programs at this point in time.
So just to reiterate that, you're feeling pretty confident that there would be no DD dollars going into the rate increases on the senior and physical disability side, that all the DD dollars would stay in the DD
Representative
programs.
Gelser, I can't guarantee that sitting here. I mean, I'll look at that, but I do not believe that we're shifting developmental disability dollars that were allocated into the senior side.
Okay. So more questions, is that okay? Can you assure that, and I am here because I believe in this bill and I know that we need to address this question. Representative Cowan and I have had a number of conversations over the last couple of days, so I don't want to set off any alarm bells with this question. But I was surprised. I think as we began this discussion, beginning the discussion with Representative Cowan, we were discussing specifically the assisted living facilities. And one of the concerns that I have in a system where your workforce is coming to open their homes to be foster care providers, and some of them are going to provide care for DD clients and some are going to provide for seniors and folks with physical disabilities, if you go into that system and you raise rates in one part of it and not the other, you're going to decrease the incentive and the workforce to be able to provide for those more complicated people. If I'm going to go open my home to become a foster care provider and I look and see that I can take a senior for the same cost as a person with a developmental disability, the person with a developmental disability is going to be more work and more difficult to care for and probably not have, you know, family support and others that are helping and supporting, or I can open my home and provide foster care to a senior at the same rate, I'm going to pick the senior if I'm smart or unless I'm really saintly. So my concern is about the long-term impact on our already broken developmental disability system, and I'm wondering if you can assure us that there will be no, zero, none DD clients that would be displaced by an increase on the adult foster care side for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and if you can absolutely assure us that there would be no negative impact on the workforce and no further disintegration of the DD system of long-term care if we do this adult foster care thing without addressing the DD side at the same time.
And you don't have to raise your right hand while you answer this question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, no, I can't absolutely assure that, and I wouldn't even attempt to do so. Having said that, We have multiple foster care systems. We have foster care systems for kids. We have foster care systems for people with mental illness, for developmental disabilities, and for senior and physical disability services. There's not that much crossover in those programs. There are some that have shared clients from multiple systems, but typically they are provider systems that have developed along a specific population for foster care parents that are pretty mission-driven for a particular population, which is basically good that you have folks that are really committed to a certain population. And our rate structures are dramatically different across those four populations, dramatically different. And they're funded out of multiple fund sources. On the kids side, you know, you have different fund sources. We have three different fund sources in terms of federal and state funds for our adult foster care systems. So we have not seen historically foster care providers jumping back and forth depending on where the rates are in those different systems. They've tended to remain in their sort of respective areas. And on the developmental disability side, quite frankly, we've had a huge increase in foster care. Foster care has sort of become the thing that we use often for people with very complex needs that are in crisis, simply because it's so hard to develop a group home, to build a group home, get it sited, and all of those things. So foster care has actually been growing very, very rapidly on the developmental disability side. In fact, there's some concern about the regulatory side of that and whether it's been growing too fast. So I don't think in the short run we're going to have any major dislocation. But if we don't attend to the rate equity issues across these populations, I think in the longer term we will. And that's also part of the reason on the DD side that we're going through this very extensive rate restructuring process for all of our 24-hour care, including foster care, that I think will come out with a much more better and stable rate structure that attends more specifically to client complexity and acuity issues. So, no, I can't give that assurance. I don't think it's going to be a critical issue in the short term.
Can I follow up?
Yeah, please. Follow up.
I guess part of my concern in the discussion that you and I had the other day, you had explained to me that this increase for the adult foster care providers on the senior and disabled side, it's not about acuity, it's not about fair compensation, it's about pressure to compete in the marketplace. And I just wonder how we protect a system overall if we respond reflexively to a marketplace that we don't have the ability to be competitive in, and what does that do for the populations that are never going to be able to benefit from pressures on the market because they're never going to have the cash or the resources to enter private pay into the mix. And if you, again, look at this difference, again, between these two populations, the challenge that we face, I think Representative Cowan explained it quite well, you've got this mix of Medicaid clients and private pay clients. On the DD side, you are never, ever going to have private pay clients because our system demands that these people live in poverty, as do their extended families, for most of their entire lives, most of the time. So there's never going to be the funding to do that. And in addition to that, the ability for those folks to access the system, you gave me the scatter chart that kind of looked, we were trying to look at the numbers of folks that would be impacted, but even if you look at those folks that have those less expensive needs, those DD folks with DD in the adult foster care system, we can't even see the brokenness of the system because we don't see all those folks that can't get in where their parents are 60, 70, 80 years old and still caring for these individuals, climbing in the bathtub with them, have been dealing with incontinence issues now for 40 or 50 years without even being eligible for respite. So I'm just worried as a caution as we move forward, responding to a market in a Medicaid program, how do we ever get to the equity for the folks that are living in poverty always, who are never going to bring that pressure to the table? And what kind of precedent are we setting to not kind of raise all ships at the same time when we have the opportunity to do this? Because ultimately, I do think that it's an injustice to the clients, to the care providers for those, because they don't have that tool of the market to press it. And I'm worried about whether or not we feed a crisis, because how do we stem? We go up by $260 a month now. What keeps the market from raising their rates up $500 so they still keep the Medicaid clients out? anyway, I'm really struggling with this on the foster care side, both in terms of the sustainability and just as an issue of conscience around what are we doing for this other population that just doesn't have the same financial press. So thank you for indulging my concerns.
Senator Cruz has been trying to jump in.
James, you brought up a small little point when you talked about the provider tax. And in a presentation we had 2 days ago on the expansion of OHP standard, they are making allowances for the fact that that thing's going away. And which is why they have restricted the potential population, simply because we don't have 4 years out a solution. I mean, they're looking at their tail and taking them to 2010 on that. Clearly, the provider tax is significant in here. And I know it doesn't necessarily impact the current rebalance, but it does impact the future. The plan you're developing that you're going to have midsummer, I'm assuming that is an issue that you are addressing in that as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, I don't think we are. I mean, we fought back the states and all the advocates when the federal government, CMS, attempted to lower the provider tax rate from 6 to 3% or whatever it was and do it almost on a precipitous basis. All the states fought back, and we had champions in Congress then that set it at 5.5, but essentially held back CMS from what they had attempted to do. I think that really will be an issue in the next administration and the next session of Congress where they go forward with the provider tax. But at this point in time, we are so dependent on the provider tax for part of the funding for nursing homes that if that suddenly goes away, we would have a very significant hole in our budget. Because, again, when we started this, the provider tax on the nursing home side, I think we were at $111 a day. We're now at almost $185 a day or so. So we would have a significant general fund gap to make up, or the rates would basically go into free fall. So I think we're still counting on the fact that with Congress we'll be able to press forward with some variation of the current provider tax, and hopefully at the rate it's been set at now, but we don't know.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And quite honestly, I've been skeptical of CMS's ability long term to allow states to do a Medicaid-only sort of tax, quite simply because to a degree we're gaming the system. We clearly are. But having said that, to expand the provider tax out beyond Medicaid is something that may be difficult to do, to say the least. So I guess it's a concern I have because it is a significant portion of the funding here, and I would hope that we would be looking. I mean, clearly one alternative is general fund. Clearly, where we'd come up with that, God only knows. But I think it's an issue as you're moving forward and as you're developing into the summer, what you're going to present to us. I think contingencies along those lines of it may disappear. What do we do? Need to be part of your thinking,
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Did you have a response? I want to make sure I wasn't interrupting.
Okay. No, it's a real concern, and you're well aware of it. But we need to know the impacts of the disappearance of that, and what alternatives might be available to us. So,
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I'd like to bring us back, I think, a little bit to this LC draft and. Representative Gelzer and I have had a number of conversations, and she very eloquently explains the challenges to the developmentally disabled community about which she it has a lot of concern, as do I. And so I want to say for that part of the conversation. I really appreciate the fact that there is a task force looking at those rates, and that it is a huge question that we need to delve into. And the issue that was just raised by the disappearing senator on the nursing home and the rates and the provider tax is another piece of the overall long-term care system. It sort of, both of those sort of feed into my earlier comments about the complexity and the challenges of addressing the whole range of challenges that we have out there. I'd like to try to clarify about whether or not adult foster care for seniors and people with physical disabilities was intended to be included in the bill. And part of that is my vision and my perception going into this from my personal experience in the realm of taking care of elderly family relatives, elderly relatives. So I will apologize if I shorten the terminology to seniors, but I'm looking at the range of available housing for aging individuals that sort of runs the gamut from what could be classified as a residential care facility, adult or an assisted living facility, or an adult foster care facility. And the reason for that is that I have seen the progressive decline in that particular population, where they started out living very independently in a senior residence and moved into some care levels through assisted living, and eventually that was not able to meet all of their needs and they moved into adult foster care. None of those kinds of services requiring the skilled nursing that you might find in what we traditionally call nursing homes, but just a progression of a decline in ability and a need for more attention. And so the one comment that that I have a little concern about, and that I'd like you to see if between you could paint a little bit of a picture for the record, is in terms of the kinds of needs of individuals who might be living in adult foster care, sort of that perception of whether caring for an individual with developmentally disabilities or a fairly compromised senior, if one is less challenging. And I think that it's important, you mentioned mission-driven, it's important to note that sort of the design and the care delivery system for individuals is very different, but that the care for a compromised elderly person in an adult foster care situation is also very challenging, and certainly we need to respect the individuals that provide that kind of care. So I was wondering if you could kind of give us a picture of perhaps the sorts of challenges from the acuity level and all of the eligibility determinations one might find in that population that runs a gamut of what I'm been trying to address here, which is sort of the whole range of care.
Madam Chair, and then Mary can maybe fill in. on the developmental disability side, about half or so, or slightly less than half, of the 1,600 people we serve on the developmental disability side in foster care are roughly in the range of rates that sort of equate to what the rates would be on the senior and physical disability side. And then you have a whole group that have rates that some which go into the stratosphere, because you have people that have extraordinary medical or behavioral needs that can't be even served in a group home. An environment with five people plus staff is even too large or complex for people that have just unbelievable behavioral challenges. So we have some very, very high-rate foster care settings that have sort of become the go-to option for people with really complex needs on the developmental disability side. And that's where we've had sort of a very significant increase in the number of homes in recent years for that population. On the senior and physical disability side, the rates overall have not gone into such a high level, except for certain populations, like we have ventilator-dependent folks that we serve in foster care at $6,000 or $7,000 a month. So we have it almost equate to a nursing home rate. And actually, folks on ventilators that most nursing homes, even skilled settings, won't take, that we serve in foster homes at about an equivalent rate. So yes, we have some people with very high acuity needs on the senior and physical disability side. And having said that, overall, I think as we've not adjusted the rates on the physical and disability on the senior and physical disability side, we're challenging all parts of our system, assisted living, residential care, and our foster care system, to serve people with higher acuity needs. We just have not, we've taken great pride to say we don't serve people in nursing homes, and we serve people with complex needs on the community side, and yet our rates have been flat. We don't give cost of living adjustments. We haven't revisited those rate structures. Hence, I mean, that all led to kind of the discussion in Ways and Means this last session, hence the budget note, hence some of the language you're including here, to say you've got to come up with an acuity-based system that really, in a meaningful way, addresses complexity of care. So I think that's kind of the heart of our discussion. And I think Representative Gelser raised a really important point. On the one hand, for one population, we serve kind of 100% Medicaid captive population, if you want to call it that. They're almost all Medicaid. They don't have private pay resources. And on the other hand, we compete in a private market. And so how do you look at those two different systems? And the challenges, in many ways, are different to assure that you have viable programs on providers that are completely dependent on Medicaid. And that was the huge debate we had this last session with our 24-hour residential group homes, where we did a major rate increase. The governor proposed you actually added to that because we had such a crisis in staffing those homes and the turnover rates and the vacancy rates. But that was another crisis response, quite frankly. That was, you know, an attempt to fill in the gap to try to stabilize it while we look at a longer-term solution. So I think we have to look at both systems very, very carefully and what will keep both viable. When you're competing in a private pay market, it's different, and we don't know how to resolve that exactly, because Representative Gelser is absolutely right. Are we just going to chase private pay, and whatever the private pay market rate is, then we chase it with a Medicaid rate? And we can't do that, because we are competing against a private pay market that will explode geometrically as well as the population grows. And I think we, on the senior and physical disability side, may almost have to do some of the parallels with the DD system, is to go out and actually develop mission-driven, Medicaid-specific programs so we're assured of capacity. Or we may even have to start, and I think industry representatives would shudder, we may have to look at kind of what's the public interest in how rates are raised on the private pay side, and is there some public interest in legislative oversight in that, or is it just the private market does what it does? So I think those are the challenges ahead, and we are, I should say, with the industry on the private pay side, we're having, I think, some very productive discussions to say how can we, at a minimum, make sure that people who spend down don't then get dislocated and have to move. So we don't take people into assisted living, have them spend down, and say, oops, you know, you're out the door now. And in the meantime, there's no other capacity because we've abandoned the rest of the Medicaid program. So we have to deal with that. We're thinking with the industry what kind of Medicaid contracting scenarios we could do that would provide better assurance as people spend down, they don't have to then leave. But this is, to kind of summarize, the issues, the demand is exploding. The federal government wants to cut back on all the possibilities of federal match. We compete in a very tight general fund market in this state, and we have a huge workforce crisis. Even if we have the money to pay for all these services, our ability to recruit and train and maintain the workforce and keep up with livable wages on that side. So you think of those three or four dynamics all in a situation where the demand is more than going to double in the next 20 years, it is a huge challenge. And we simply don't have the answers at this point. I mean, I think we're methodically trying to plan and look at all these variables, but there are no simple solutions. It's not a simple rate adjustment here or a rate adjustment there, and we absolutely agree that you can't look at any of these systems in isolation of each other. It is a very complex set of interactions, and we have to look at this very comprehensively in terms of solutions. So I don't know if that helps answer, but in part it's a non-answer because...
Let me just wrap this piece up, if I could, please. Yeah. What I would just like to comment on is there are several pieces of this, and certainly some of the, for lack of a better term, lower-level care we're losing on the community-based side is part of the reason that's driving this, both in the senior and people with physical disabilities population, and the challenge that I do understand in the developmentally disabled side of individuals who might have lesser care needs that aren't even in the system yet. This is an extremely complex question, and it's also the beauty of the kind of conversations that we're bringing out here today, is that it's time that we begin to make the larger population aware of the very daunting challenges throughout this system, and that's really what the role of this bill is to start opening those conversations. I think the federal issue being pulled into it certainly challenges us to take this debate on to a national level and some bigger pictures. I also think that we will be hearing testimony, not likely today, but probably during session, from individuals in the private market that they do feel that this will be a temporary stopgap measure that will be helpful in stemming the challenge that we're seeing right at this particular moment. But I just like to say that there are no simple answers, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us. This is really only intended to temporarily stem one problem and launch a much bigger conversation.
Representative Maurer.
No.
Okay, we're going to have to move along.
I just have some technical questions.
Yes.
Because I'm not as conversant with this LC draft. Can I ask some technical questions?
Absolutely.
On page 2, section 1, subsection 2, it says the Department of Human Services shall establish for the biennium July 1, 2007, Medicaid reimbursement rates for those residential care facilities, and it goes on for line 25. Mm-hmm. I guess all of you in the committee know the answer to this. I don't, so I'll just look foolish. Have they established those rates?
Mr. and Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, actually we have some problems with this language because it's somewhat different than a group of us, including Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette, had worked on what I thought was language that would better work. This appears...
Let me stop. I'm not trying to embarrass you. My question was, have you... And whether you have or not, I assume you said you haven't. Basically, you haven't established the rules.
Well,
right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, what we will do in our payment and our rate structure, assuming what happens with our rebalance plan, is, yes, we will change the rates for those facilities that are listed here, adjusted by that $9.7 million and the $260 a month per person. But that's not been done at this point. That would be done after...
Okay. My question then is, mm-hmm. when you do whatever you just said you're going to do, which I'm just not very good at it, will it be retroactive to July 1, 2007?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, no, it will not.
Okay.
The way it's been budgeted, it would go into effect April 1st of 2008.
Okay. Thank you. Can I ask just a few more on the legislation, because that's all I know.
Yeah.
If you go to page 4, subsection 7, lines 3 through 6, increase the training capacity in this state to address shortages in the recruitment retention. Is it the committees and certified smart people on this committee, all of which you are except me, does that language get to the issues? And I'm referring to you, Chair Morissette. You were very much impressed with Meredith Cote's written and verbal testimonies. Does that get to all the issues that she raised regarding recruitment, in terms of that language there, regarding training and that? For example, She noted that there is a problem with the number of instructors that we have. She noted that you don't have a mandatory universal standard core curriculum. I think that does that language get to all those issues, or is it, no, Peter, we don't want to get to those issues. We still want, I thought the testimony was that each facility gets to decide their curriculum and their instructors. And I don't know philosophically where all you are on that, but assuming you thought there was some merits in the written and verbal testimony earlier by the ombudsperson, does this language, chairs, to your knowledge, sufficiently get us to all the areas? Because recruitment and retention could mean you simply increase the hourly wage, et cetera. I'm not trying to be smart aleck here. So all the issues that are raised, you got to have more instructors, they got to be qualified, you got to have a standard curriculum. Is that all in that language? So, Mr. Chair, so maybe that question should go to you folks, not to these people.
Well, the language that we have in much of this bill now, I'll take a look at the introduction where we have all of the whereases. Now, what we have done is worked with the various providers, the advocates, the stakeholders, and they each submitted parts of the bill that they want to address, and the whereas is kind of lay the groundwork. Now, as far as the training, no, this doesn't get to all of the training of the workforce that is required, and that's the purpose of this bill, is to be kind of a comprehensive approach to the needs of senior long-term care, is to try to define the parameters that we're working with. And so the language is a roadmap, and we will be discussing the details of those. Now, is this language inclusive? I guess it kind of sets that.
Can I just ask, yeah. I'm not trying in any way to be a smart aleck.
No,
I'm just
no.
Stumbling through this in one kindergarten way. The Section 3 does say Department of Human Resources is supposed to do all these things and report to the next general session legislature. So I'm just trying to figure out if it's important that we have a certain number of qualified instructors, if it's important we have a core curriculum. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going with a certified smart aleck.
Yeah.
Then perhaps we should consider that. Now, let me just ask two more, and I'll be still because I know you're anxious. Where is the issue of inspections addressed in here? Now, that was brought up to, again, maybe you feel we have sufficient inspections, but the issue that you should go to an annual inspection was brought up. Is that in here, too, in the language? Okay. Then one last thing. Section 1 of this 2008 Act is repealed January 2, 2010. Why is that there? Why is line 22 of page 4 in there? Why are you repealing Section 1? I mean, in terms of... And again, I don't mean to make noise like a lawyer, but why is that?
Do we... Section 1 of this act...
Well, I'm not... Bill, again, I'm trying to... I'm sure there's a... I'm just curious to know...
Go ahead. Take a crack at that.
The intent of this bill is to highlight the fact that the department is currently in the process of developing a comprehensive plan for the system. And Section 3's intention is to highlight some pieces that the advocacy community in general have brought to attention that need to be talked about, and we wanted to be sure that as part of that comprehensive planning we get some cost projections on what some of the things that folks would like to do might cost for further consideration in 2009. I don't have a specific answer about the repeal, except that this particular rate increase was intended to be kind of a temporary stopgap until we take a look at the bigger system, and whether that specific language should be in there or not, I'm not going to address that. But what I do want to say is that each of the items are not intended to that are listed in Section 3 are not intended to be all-inclusive of everything that we need to do, but rather to start that conversation that we need to progress with. So this bill is not intended to address everything, and the reason we're taking ongoing testimony is to kind of figure out what more needs to be in that discussion.
Okay. Now, first, okay. Section 1 of this bill has not, the language is still in flux, and originally we had a dollar amount in there, and I think this might have been a carryover from the fact that we did have specific language that we did want to repeal. Secondly, as Mr. Tave said, he is not completely happy with the language in Section 1, and that has changed significantly, because at one point we had a reference in there to a federal act that CMS, where they said the state shall provide adequate services statewide comparable to the private market. Now, that's a requirement, so to speak, from the federal government. We had that in the bill at one point, and we took that out because with that we were kind of uncomfortable with that. So the language in this bill, the good news is that nothing in this bill necessarily is binding. We're not tying people in chains, saying that they have to do this. The bad news is that it is somewhat vague, but it is a roadmap. The most significant part of this bill will be the Section 1, I think, that and the most significant contribution that will be made to it is keeping the rebalance so they can actually do something. It's interesting because the fiscal came from the budget notes that were in the Ways and Means that directed the division to do something by the next during this biennium. And so when we went to them and said, gee, we want to do a bill that deals with the baby boomer program, they said, well, we're already going to do some of that stuff. So, you know, that saved us writing a bill that would truly require an extra fiscal. So this is a roadmap. The language is concurrent to what the department is doing, and that's the beauty of it. We have worked closely with the department, with the agency, with the division, and we're trying to help them do what they're already directed to do. At the same time, we have brought in a group of providers who are saying, each of us have a different mission in life. I mean, the AAAs deal with acuity. There are other providers here. So, yeah, I guess that one section that you asked about repealing, yeah, I think that was in there because we didn't want Section 1 to have some unintended consequences.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The President made a good point, because if you read Section 1, Sub 2, it says one thing in the at the beginning and another at the end, because it does say effective beginning of the biennium, and then at the end it says effective beginning at the date of implementation of the bill, which I think is probably what it should be. Is the rates will go into effect then. Of course, one could argue the question that if the rate adjustment's in the rebalance, why does it need to be in the bill? And I think that's something we need to address as well, which would mean that section could potentially disappear, as well as the repeal of the section, which wouldn't need to be there if the section's gone. So I think sub 2 is confusing in the way it's written. It really has two effective dates in it, it's something we need to consider, and we need to consider the fact that potentially there would be a fiscal here. If we're allowing the rebalance to deal with the rate, then there is no fiscal in the bill. So that's one piece. The other piece is when the President was talking about the training capacity, really what Section 3 is about is asking the department to put some cost figures on these various components. It's not about developing anything. It's cost components. Which is something that's really relevant to us moving forward, is this whole laundry list that's in Section 3 is what's it going to cost?
Yeah.
And that's what Section 3 is asking for, is that specifically. So I fully understand that we have some, you know, this is kind of a point in time and microcosm of bigger issues, but this isn't asking for development per se. It's asking for cost of what they're already developing in their work plan.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for that, because during the last interim when we had a series of meetings and with the providers, and one of the things that they were concerned about is the costing out of figures, and so we've used that term, which sometimes is misleading, but we want to come into the 09 session with an idea of the dollar amounts that are being asked for to do some of the things that we think are important. And that's where Section 3 of this bill comes in. The whereas is an in Section 3.
Okay, just one last thing. Yeah. But it is your intention that this be introduced in the February session and passed?
Yes.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
So, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And we had the discussion before the meeting, and we were going to have the Legislative Council here. She may be on the phone. Unless we have specific language questions about the language, we won't deal with that. But this bill, the intent is to move the bill today. If there are changes that need to be made before the 18th, we would have to come back and meet. But we would do it then when the bill is heard in February, because we would have amendments to the bill during the February hearing, and then we could make whatever changes are necessary. So this is somewhat complicated, but yet it is not a binding piece of legislation, as Senator Cruz mentions. You know, why do we even have some of this language in here if we're already going to do it? Well, we want to have it here to reinforce the roadmap for the future is what we want to do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Since we're asking questions about the technical nature of the language.
No, okay. But
it's.
Go ahead.
In Section 1, as we've just had the discussion in terms of the rates, we specifically and intentionally exclude developmental disabilities from that for all the reasons we've just discussed. Are people with developmental disabilities intentionally excluded from Section 3 and the statements around training capacity, mental health and addiction, licensing, et cetera? And if not, might we consider adding DD in there, since we're referring to seniors and persons with disabilities, and that is a department that does include that population? And they're excluded in the other part of the bill, to make it clear.
Yes, we could. Yeah, in Section 3.
In Section 3.
Okay, now that raises another question. Are we going to acknowledge... Okay, we're going to hear testimony in just a minute from people who do want to be included, and we want to be inclusive. We want to be careful, though, that we don't require... we don't put programs in the mix that are going to defeat the purpose of what we're doing. So we have to be careful of how we do that. But we want to be inclusive. And so I think the developmentally disabled nursing home situation is not only extremely important, it's very much related to what we're doing. So we want to acknowledge that whenever possible. Okay.
Could we get comment from the department on that question?
Okay. Yeah. And then we're going to move on, because we have a whole bunch of people that we're going to hear from, and we're going to be out of here at noon. So go ahead.
No, I just wondered if the department
would
could
you
respond,
like to respond
to Representative Gelser's question about Section 3.
If you're
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, again, this all evolved out of first the budget note and the hearings around the senior and physical disability side. I mean, if you want to add some components to DD, we've kind of viewed DD as having its own planning track, I mean, that's entirely up to you.
And I think, Mr. Chair, an alternative would be just to change the language then, instead of persons with disabilities, to people with physical disabilities. And the same in the beginning, where it talks about persons with severe disabilities, and on line 8 on page 2, switching that to physical disabilities. It helps to not confuse and continue to slide DD under the rug.
We'll make note of that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you're saying
Nicole Palmatier,
I just want to make sure I
have it. Lauren had to leave, right? Okay. Okay.
Physical. Every time it says persons with disabilities, just okay. Because we add in TBI.
It's addressed.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. No. Let's see. That's another mission. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you for the record. My name is Nicole Armstrong, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disability. I'll be extremely brief. Lauren Rose with the Oregon Healthcare Association did have to leave, but she wanted me to express OHCA support of Legislative Concept 28 and all the work that's gone into that. On behalf of O4AD, we support Legislative Concept 28 and all of the tremendous leadership and collaborative work that's gone into this. And I know that there's been a lot of leadership from Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette, as well as other members of these committees, to really look at the broader issues in this system. And if there's only one thing that O4AD can say is that this bill brings forward a band-aid of relief for a very emergent issue with the Medicaid rates and community-based care, but it also looks forward to the 2009 session and the costing out of elements in order to give the next legislative body the tools they need to really look at the system. This is really what it's going to cost. What do we decide? What do we choose are our priorities? And we think that we've done a lot of planning in the past. We've done a lot of plans. There's a lot of ideas. There's a lot of concepts. And now we really need to get to the part where the rubber hits the road. It's time to turn those plans into actual action in order that our seniors and our people with physical disabilities in this instance can receive the kinds of care and supports that they need to be able to stay in their home, to stay in their communities, and at such time as they need to move to a facility-based care, be able to have the proper supports in place to make sure that that care is adequate and at a quality that we would all expect for any of our family members or ourselves. So I have submitted written testimony and a little bit of information about Project Independence, which is a program there's been a lot of discussion on, and I know will be a lot of discussion in the February session. We look forward to being a part of that, and we thank you very much.
Okay. You raise a really good point in terms of the big picture, and you mentioned part of the big picture, which we haven't even talked about, Project Independence. Oregon Project Independence is basically the foundation of this long-term care. We haven't specifically addressed that. I think that the Ways and Means Committee will probably hear testimony to put more money into the Project Independence program. This bill doesn't specifically deal with that program as such, but it is, I think, maybe one of the single most important pieces of the long-term care that there is. And the acuity issue that you also work with in the AAA is an important issue, too. How do we deal with people who have somewhat serious problems that are on the verge of going into a nursing home, but with the proper in-home care could stay in their own home? And so that's one of the gaps, I think, in our service area. So.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, we would absolutely agree. And one of the elements of the costing out that's included in Section 3 of the bill is Project Independence. With Project Independence, it's always been sort of a victim of appropriation at will, rather than what this bill does, which asks to look at what is the need. And just based on, you know, best estimates that we can come, about between 100 and 150,000 people in Oregon could access Project Independence via being senior or a person with a physical disability with that. And with the numbers we serve now, we haven't even touched that. So being able to look at what is the need, how much does that cost, and what would the cost avoidance be for the state? What were the savings that we would realize by allowing these people to be able to access Project Independence versus having to enter into a facility-based care earlier than they need to? And that is a very essential part of this bill that we are very pleased to see in there.
Now, would you mind talking about the equity issue, please?
I love to talk about the equity issue.
I thought you would.
The equity issue is something that...
Wait, explain the equity issue.
Certainly. The equity issue relates to the Area Agencies on Aging in statute. Let's go back. When the Area Agencies on Aging the five transfers that serve up and down the I-5 corridor, and those five transfers serve approximately 75% of seniors and people with disabilities in the long-term care system because of the population centers that are in that area. When they transferred those services from DHS into the AAA system, we agreed to do those services for 95% of what it actually costs. We said, we'll take it on. We think it's going to be good in a local and community area, and we'll do it for a little bit less. We'll let the state realize savings. However, because of the equity gap, the reimbursement rate has never been at 95%. Therefore, the area agencies have had to, in those five areas, have had to provide services at anything from ranging, I believe, from the middle 70% up to we're about 90% right now. So we've never reached full equity. What that means in practical terms to a client is somebody can call up one of the area agencies and we would love to make an appointment and talk to you about services that you need and how to get you involved in a part of the long-term care system, but you're going to have a wait of about 4 weeks before we can talk to you because we're so backlogged by lack of available staff, by all the different work constraints that there are within the AAAs, because if you don't have enough money to provide the services, you don't have it. And so the equity issue is getting at moving the area agencies in those areas up to the 95% so that, you know, we have all of the equipment that we need to be able to provide the services. Extremely important to us. We don't feel good about having to have people wait. We don't feel good about not having the full capacity for case management and assessment that we need to be able to provide as many options as possible. But when there's a push and we are seeing more clients with higher impairity levels now, and the number of clients coming through the door is greater and greater and greater. The age wave, yes, is in 2025, but it's here today already. And we see that on a day-to-day basis, and we need to have that. The LC calls for a look at what is equitable funding and also looks at that based on workload standards. In other words, there's an amount of work it takes to do what we do from the time a person comes in the door to be able to fund that, or at least look at funding that based on that time that it takes for that work rather than waiting until that person is an official case is incredibly important to how we are adequately funding that work within the area agencies.
Okay. And that discussion occurred before the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Health, and I think that the department acknowledged the need, and I think that that's part of the costing out. That's part of what this bill directs the agency to do, is come in and say how much it's going to cost to come up to the 95% of equity.
Mm-hmm. Chair Morris, that's exactly it, as well as looking longer term as the need increases, yeah. How we need to change how that reimbursement rate or how workload impacts that. We do hope that we see equity in the rebalance that comes forward in the February session. We're not sure, but we hope to see some sort of an adjustment there to be able to continue to move towards that 90%.
Now, you touched on another interesting term, which is cost avoidance. It's a better term than savings, because when you use the word savings, that implies that there's money that is available for other people to use for something else. And so a better term is cost avoidance. How much cost can we avoid by implementing a plan that will basically save money, but it's cost avoidance? And that, I think, is what we're looking at. Hopefully we'll come up through the rest of this interim with a comprehensive senior long-term care plan that will show all of these parts, and we will have a unified approach, including cost avoidance, so we can start working on putting money into programs that will pay a known dividend later on, which is what we're doing with this nursing home, with the repayment rates. So, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dolores Dietzel and Stephen Herbert. Megan Moyer.
Dolores is going to start first.
My name is Dolores Dietzel,
and I'm a relative foster home provider for my daughter. She was diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 5. She had a stroke at the age of 12. Her left side is paralyzed, and it also affected her mental status. Recently, I've been put on Social Security, and I'm allowed to take care of my daughter, but I need more money. I had a rate reduction within my office, my local office, that cut my money $236 a month. And that was done because my daughter isn't banging her head up against the wall. But she's still disabled. She's still mentally impaired. She has the mind of a 12 to 13, 14-year-old. I need extra funding. My daughter and I live in poverty because, I'm only getting so much Social Security, and I'm only allowed to care for my daughter. I can't care for anybody else. And it's hard. And I'm having trouble because I don't hear a lot talked about the relative foster care provider. And we're important. My daughter was in a commercial facility for 1 year. During that time, she was hospitalized 5 different times via ambulance. Hospital stay a couple of days. And during that time, if she would have been in my care, it would have meant a doctor's visit, which I take her to all of her doctor's appointments. I know her doctors. I've dealt with them for years. And so I know that the relative foster care home provider needs more help.
Thank you.
Okay. My name is Steve Hebert. I am a commercial DDS licensed adult foster home. And I've came asking for the DDS homes to be included in the increase in rate pay that you're considering for SPD. I originally became licensed under the SPD system, and after several years of taking clients, and my clients began to become more and more DDS, I made the license change. And for those of you who may or may not know about the licensing, the requirement to become an SPD home was a educational system, almost one quarter of education at a state-sponsored instructional event at the college that is in the town that I live in, which is Coos Bay. And thereafter, we were examined and then licensed depending upon inspections of our homes. Upon becoming a DDS license, which is a more specialized license, meaning it takes more training, it took 8 hours of continuous education. This education was an instructional video in which we were watched, and then we took testing thereafter, and the testing was almost a one-hour comprehensive test to judge our ability to be able to gain that DDS license. I think the thoughts that I have about foster homes being included, and I know that you've already included SPD, is they are so important. And the governor, when he had a task force studying them, found that the adult foster homes that they studied, the age group of those foster homes had increased to the point that most of the foster homes were very old, that very few people were entering into foster homes. And in his task force, he wanted to know why. SPD homes in Coos County, as the DHS representative James Hayes said, are given a base rate, a support rate of 969. He said actually 950. The DDS homes currently are being given a base rate of $527. The DHS representative said that DDS homes were not bailing out, were not going elsewhere, or he did not notice changes due to different rates. Well, I can tell you at this point, DDS homes are bailing out of their licenses in the Coos County. They are trying to go to anything else that can be of support that they can actually be able to take care of their clients. The current level of 527 comes down to 73 cents an hour. That basically is $17 a day. My wife and I work 24 hours a day. We've worked 1 year this year with no breaks, period. It is impossible to hire a person at minimum wage to make more money in that same day than we actually get paid by the department. So we can have no breaks. The foster care home and the foster care providers, if that type of thing were to continue, it would be something that we would see as an extinction of such a process. This cottage industry that gives a continuum of care, not every shift somebody else sees your loved one, and nobody knows exactly what happened last shift, whether they were puking or vomiting or passing blood. This continuum of care is 24 hours a day. We're even at the hospital with our people. If you were loved in your home as children, that's exactly what you are at a foster home. You don't get a staff that 8 hours later or the next week may not even be there. We're there as a family forever with these people. My people don't ever want to leave. Every one of them have expressed they want to die in our home. They want to be with us forever. But at 527, even our home will probably be closing before long. So I am asking for increases in pay. Yes, I think DDS is in need of it. I welcome any questions you have. I know there's a lot of people wanting to testify. If you have them, I would be more than happy to.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Could we just get some clarity for the record? We've heard several initials run around here, and maybe we can get the clarity in the next testimony. But SPD homes, as opposed to, it means seniors and people with disability, but and then we're talking DDS, and I'm not quite sure where
I'm. The DDS is Developmentally Disabled Service. Madam Chair, is there something more I can say?
No, I'm trying to get clarity for the record of the differentiation.
DDS, and in this particular case, it would be the MRDD, Mentally Retarded Developmentally Disabled, that is in my home particularly.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm just here to answer any questions that our providers are unable to answer.
I'd like to say something.
Introduce yourself again for the record.
I'm Dolores Dietzel.
Okay.
And I'm being a relative foster care provider. I haven't got training. Any training that I've gotten has been on my own initiative. It's been paid for in private insurance when my husband had insurance. And so there's no training. I've gotten no instruction on how to keep records or anything like that from where I'm at. And I'm concerned about that. But I'm really concerned that just in the general talk, that the relative foster care providers aren't not included in your conversation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Chair. I did have only one more thought that as I was listening to the conversations of the prior testimonies and the, again, the DHS department that was testifying stated that the adult foster homes were inspected annually. The DDS homes that are in Coos Bay are inspected monthly. The monitoring goes on for several hours a day when they come in for the monitoring. So inspections are at great length and much different than you're realizing.
But no training.
The training has been set up by the legislature in the past, and that would be a 10-hour continuous education.
Well, okay, you mentioned that. But you did not have training.
No. My training has been my life experience with my daughter. I'm very open to doctors. I communicate with the doctors. taking classes on different things to educate myself more. But there's been no offer of any training for me being just a relative foster care provider.
Okay. No.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just as a point of clarification, I think it would be interesting at some point to have the department talk to us a little bit about one of the problems in our DD system and the challenges of case management is that some counties have just completely dumped their DD programs because the counties can't afford to operate them anymore. Coos County is one of those, and so it is actually operated by a private provider. The county said, you didn't give us the resources, we won't provide the services anymore. Go find someone else to do it.
I would like.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Morissette and Chair Cowan, members of the committees, I would like to make a point.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. I just would like to make a point around relative providers and the role that they play. There are, this year, there are close to 1,500 SPD or seniors and people with disabilities being served by relatives as a relative adult foster homes. We have seen this from DHS numbers since 2001 to 2007. The number of clients being served by relatives has decreased 29.2%. It is becoming more and more difficult for families to have this as an option, to be able to take care of their loved ones. And I think it goes without saying that if a family can't do it, a commercial provider is going to have to. And so we view it as if this is another crisis where if we made it more possible for families, they could continue to do it at a lower rate than we pay the commercial provider. But the consequence of making it impossible for families is an inevitable moving into a commercial setting, be it adult foster home or a residential care facility. Thank you.
That is a cost avoidance issue, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bob Lawrence, Bill Olson. We're going to be done by now. Going to be out here by
fighting
sea.
Fighting
sea. Yeah. Bob, go ahead and introduce yourself and let's get started.
Well, good morning, Senator Morissette and Representative Cowan and members of the committee. My name is Bob Lawrence. I'm the legislative coordinator and the chair of the Legislative Advocacy Committee for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. Mm-hmm. And with your indulgence, I will stick to my text because if I become too extemporaneous, I get into trouble. So we are really appreciative of all the work that went into the development of LC 28. It has been a really diligent and hard process. The Commission is very pleased that LC 28 has incorporated many of the issues and policies contained in its legislative agenda during the last legislative session. The Commission also notes that many of the policies brought forth in its report to the legislature and the governor, riding the wave of call to action, are contained in LC 28. The emphasis of the commission has always been to plan for the future. The report was the direct result of the community forums conducted with the commission, senior and people with disabilities, and O4AD. LC 28 also embodies many of the elements contained in the Baby Boomer Preparedness Act and the Older Oregonian Act that was submitted during the last legislative session. There are three main themes in LC 28 that caught our attention. Number one, this legislative concept spells out the necessity to re-examine the statutory mandate for services to seniors contained in the unique ORS 410. As you are all aware, ORS 410 was created by advocates and the legislature working together to produce a statute that provided the framework for services to seniors that became a model for the nation. We can do it again. Number two, LC 28 provides the framework of legislative activity to increase the partnership with the community of people with disabilities. We hope to further our attempts to decategorize programs like Oregon Project Independence and eliminate the budgetary set-asides. Number three, LC 28 also specifically delineates the responsibility of all advocates to work together in the mental health field, particularly for the underserved population. Thank you once again, and we are looking forward to whatever we can do to help with this process.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bill?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm co-chair of the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I'm here to comment on LC 28. The coalition's focus at this time and for the past couple of sessions really has been the restoration and enhancement of Oregon's long home and community-based care system. And I should add, care probably is a little too passive. I'd rather say care and support system, because I think support to those people who are capable of greater independence isn't a critical part of the system, but I hope that's understood. We're concerned that this system has been eroding over the past number of legislative sessions. We understand the budgetary reasons for that, but we're not satisfied that that is the direction we can continue to go. So we're encouraged that LC 28 might be a vehicle to help move us toward that shared goal, we hope shared goal, of restoration of our system and enhancement of the system. We strongly support the bills or the legislative concepts, priority emphasis on reimbursement rate restructuring in order to stem the loss of these home and community-based housing options to institutionalized care in the form of nursing homes. Oregon is justly proud of its national recognition for having developed that home and community-based system, and we're very alarmed by the recent trends, as Mr. Tayes has presented, that show an increase in the relative percentage of placements being in nursing homes and what that portends for the future if we don't reverse it. We also support the directive to the Department of Human Services to develop a plan for the long-term care system and look forward to working with it and with other interested parties and advocacy groups to help in developing the plan. We do want to note that many elements of the plan, many of which are identified also in Section 3 of the bill, which we very much support and are gratified by, are known or understood. And that what we really need and what I hope the plan will focus on and certainly needs to contain is funding and implementation strategies so that we can begin to take action. But we do support the planning effort in that context and with that understanding. We concur with the items for which cost estimates are to be prepared for the 2009 session and are pleased to see that improving services for persons who have a traumatic brain injury has been added to the draft. I appreciate that change based on my past work with the brain injury community. However, the coalition believes that one additional item should be explicitly added to the list, and that is strengthening services and supports for family and other volunteer caregivers. We talk about the recruitment of workers for this workforce issues, and that's very important. We don't at all underestimate the importance of the paid workforce, but I think all of us need to better understand the role that volunteer caregivers are playing in the system and begin to provide some support, because the projections show us that the family caregiver and other voluntary caregivers are going to be bearing a greater portion, a greater burden in future years, just based on the demographics and the ratio of people needing care to those available to provide it. And we need to try to give them some support, particularly, I think, or just from my standpoint at least, particularly in the form of respite care, to keep them from burning out and developing health problems that in turn are going to come back and burden the public system. So with that, I again commend the work that's been done. Look forward to working with you and with others to develop this bill as it goes through session and support its implementation in the interim. And we would like to reserve the opportunity to make some comments here in the next few days, technical comments on the draft LC, if they'll be acceptable as late as early next week. We have those just about ready, but I wanted to share them with our coalition to make sure they're comfortable with the comments. Again, thank you for the opportunity, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you. We had quite a discussion about respite care during the Ways and Means process, and we did keep money in the program for the respite, which is extremely important for home caregivers to be able to get that kind of assistance so they can get out and do other things. Thank you very much. John Mullen, Tim Baxter, and Rick Bennett. We're going to start with Rick Bennett. He didn't sign up, but I just want to have Rick Bennett up here to
close this fund.
So go ahead, Rick, and lead off.
Chair Morrison, Chair Cowan, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. One of the great things about coming at the end of testimony is the fact that just about everything has been said, and a number of words that I would have used, such as crisis and Band-Aid and eroding system, have all been used. And I think all I can tell you is that AARP supports this legislative concept. There's still some fine-tuning to be done, but I think that we can accomplish what's needed there between now and when the bill is heard during the February session. I would just mention that AARP has been actively involved in the long-range planning process that's been facilitated by James Taylor and his staff. And since the closing weeks of the last legislative session, we've been actively involved in other discussions with I think, all the members of this committee or committees, as well as advocates in the department. We think this concept actually, as stated, addresses a very immediate need. And also sets the stage for what we hope will be a much broader and in-depth discussion related to our long-term system here in Oregon when we get to the 09 session. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Just will echo Rick's comments that just about everything that needs to be said about LC 28 has been said. But I think sometimes it's appropriate to also say thank you, and I really want to thank both chairs of the committees for working with us. And I think that we had a very collaborative discussion, and it's something that I hope to look back at with pride and saying this is the point in time in which we began to build back the system for seniors and people with disabilities. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Chair Morissette,
Chair Cowan, I'm Tim Baxter. I work for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. My comment has to do with something that's not featured in LC 28, although I think advocates do and should support LC 28. Last month, about 21,500 elders and people with physical disabilities received home and community-based care services from seniors and people with disability. About 11,500, 53% of those individuals did not receive those services in relative foster care or an adult foster home or an assisted living center. They received these services at home, in their own homes. The average cost of in-home services for these folks is $745 per month. The current average rate for nursing home care is $5,200 per month. Folks in their own homes receiving in-home services, they tend to be a silent, invisible factor, and frankly, I think they sometimes tend not to show up in legislation. As this work goes forward, and not just in this session but beyond, and this discussion continues, I would urge you not to forget that 53%, that other part, the people at home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, Ruth Gailis and Meredith, would you come back, please?
Chair Morissette, Chair Cohen, members of the committee, for the record, I am Ruth Gullius, Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, representing not-for-profit, mission-directed providers of long-term care, including assisted living, residential care, federally subsidized housing, and nursing homes. And I just want to go on record to say our organization strongly supports LC 28. We appreciate your leadership on this issue. We think it's a very important, it contains very important elements for the roadmap going forward. Two comments we think that I just wanted to highlight within the concept. We think it's particularly important to be looking at acuity-based reimbursement system as we move forward and going into the future. Also wanted to make a brief comment on the discussion on the private pay, chasing the private pay rate. I think last time I was up here, I spoke to just the experience and conversation I had with one of my members who had just recently put together her budget. She's their mission is to serve low income. They have the few private pay that they've had. They've raised the rates to offset the loss that they take on the Medicaid side. She can no longer do so and maintain being competitive in the community. And at the current system, she would not be able to continue to take Medicaid. She's going in the hole. But, again, I want to thank you and thank you for your leadership, and we look forward to working with you as this moves forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Meredith Cote, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I find myself in the same position that Senator Courtney is in as he looked at the bill. I was not involved in the process, so I'm only looking at the language of the bill. I have a huge respect for the intent of all those who have worked on this, and I appreciate, and many of these problems certainly resonate with our office. What I am concerned about in the language of the bill is the language in particular on section 2, subsection 2, and then it looks like it's large B on line 10, where it says developing reimbursement rates that are reasonably competitive with rates paid by private payers. I was gratified that in response to Representative Gelser's comments, James Tays indicated that we could not chase private pay rates. But this is exactly what this language purports to do if one were looking at the statute. And if we're going to go that route, I find it concerns me as a steward of taxpayer dollars to go that route. But it would seem to me that we should at least add another element. There is the Medicaid rate, which we all acknowledge is too low. Then there is the cost of providing care. We don't know what that is because it's proprietary data from the industry. And then we have the private pay rate. And I think that it would be instructive for us to, at this point in time, to find out what it costs to provide care. We do that in nursing homes, and nursing homes have to file mandatory cost reports. So we know what it costs to provide care in nursing homes, but we have no idea what it costs to provide this care in the community-based care settings. And it would seem to me that to round out our understanding of this issue, that would be an essential element rather than just attaching ourselves to a private pay rate, which is individually determined by providers. And I have seen in a community foster care rates, for example, the private pay rates, some very high, some very low, some in between. There's wide variation. So I think we should look at what the cost is of providing care. I am also concerned, just as I interpret statutes, that we not create something that is actionable, legally actionable by the industry. As you may all remember, we used to have the Boren Amendment in federal law that talked about reimbursement rates and attached that to quality of care. That ended up in lawsuits all over the country, including here, by providers seeking to have rates that were commensurate with providing quality care. And I think that we have to be careful about the language that's in statute, because it does become law. So I guess with that, I will stop. But I do think that there are approaches that perhaps we might have missed in this language that we should consider. Thank you.
Thank you. But I was looking for the reference, the statutory, federal statutory reference to something that we did have in Section 1 of this bill. I believe that I referred to that CMS says you will provide care statewide. I thought it was commensurate with what the private sector is getting. I mean, there is something like that in, you know, and that's a lawsuit kind of thing. I mean, so do we, let's take a look at the federal CMS regs and going back to 1993 and take a look at that. Now, I don't have that reference, but our legislative council came up with that, and we had that discussion. Well, are we setting ourselves up by saying that we're for sure going to do something that we can't do? Now, it looks like this section on page 3, line 10, that you mentioned is that kind of language that is maybe setting us up for something that...
Mr. Chair, like I said, I wasn't involved in any of those discussions. I am an outsider who's just looking at the language. I'm troubled by it both conceptually and as it is specifically in there. And perhaps I can be better informed by those who know what the federal is requiring. I will be shocked, but... I guess I would be shocked if the federal government is attaching Medicaid rates to private
pay
rates.
Well, actually,
I would be quite surprised, okay. But I've been surprised before.
Mr. Chair,
let me finish. So my committee administrator just reminded me that it says provide access now instead of rates. Okay, you provide access statewide to what the private sector is providing. That implies rates.
Mr. Chair, that can imply rates, but it can imply a whole lot
of other
ways.
Okay, okay. So that was one of the things that we were... Okay, this language... The original language was that federal reg, which would kind of call attention that the state had some obligations to do. Now, we took that reference out, but we put something even... more onerous.
For example, Mr. Chair, and I'm not suggesting this is an approach at all, but one of the ways to get to that federal language would be what you do in nursing homes, which is it is Medicaid discrimination to discriminate at the point of admission between a Medicaid client and a private pay client. We've never done that in community-based care. I'm not suggesting we should, but that would certainly get to the issue that
you
just raised in terms of the access issue.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now,
Mr. Chair, basically, this isn't putting anything in statute. It's asking for recommendations.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just asking the department for recommendations on this list. It isn't putting any reimbursement rate in statute. It's just asking the department for recommendations of achieving that. So that's the way it reads.
That are reasonably competitive with rates paid.
But the comprehensive plan must include recommendations for. Okay. So this is just asking for recommendations. It's not putting it in statute.
Okay. I guess what we're talking about are interpretation of language that could lead to some unintended consequences.
Mr. Chair, my concern is attaching the public Medicaid rates to the private pay rates. I think that there's some steps that perhaps should be taken in looking at how we get to a new rate. And the language of this bill suggests that perhaps, for example, cost of providing services is not something that is articulated within the language of this particular bill. So it seems to be focusing more on Medicaid rates and private pay rates versus the cost of providing services, which is an element.
Okay. Well, and I think Senator Cruz is absolutely right. We're looking for costing out of programs. So, Representative
Collins. Yes, please.
And then Representative Maurer. And then we're going to have to move.
Yes.
A couple of things, if I could, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to make clear. The relationship with federal law and federal directives was never a part of the original intention for this bill. The question came up in ongoing discussions, and we got back to the kind of language that we have here because we were trying to be very careful that this bill is not a directive to do any one thing, but it's probably in many ways unnecessary, the bill itself. We could go ahead with comprehensive planning without a specific piece of legislation. The desire is to focus our collective intelligence and interest and energies around a system that needs to be updated and to have some things addressed. Many of the concepts that came up and ended up in here in section, whatever section I'm in now, section 2, this particular line that we're talking about on page 3, line 10, is intended to foster a conversation about where we need to go in making things competitive. These are all things that are aimed at, once we see the comprehensive planning that the Department of Human Services has done, and asking them to give us some cost projections so that in 2009, when we have some more focused conversation about these various issues, we can be sure to put all the pieces into it. It certainly isn't intended to attach rates directly to a private market or any of those kinds of concerns that I've heard raised. I do understand that when you put something in statute, you put something in statute, but the directive that's going in statute is that we need to talk about this.
Okay. Representative Maurer, we're going to have to move this bill in about 5 minutes. Right. So we've got to really
my only concern in that conversation is using cost report data and creating a new type of cost report, because you would have to create a new type of cost reporting system. And there are, in the world of cost reporting, it's like statistics. There are lies, there are darn lies, and then there are cost reports. And I think we just have to be extremely careful going down that road.
Okay, I will quote you.
And I said darn.
At least he said darn. I heard that.
He did. Very good. Thank you for that insight. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just telling Representative Maurer that I wasn't going to say anything in keeping with my quiet nature.
I've never seen.
You're in keeping with your quiet nature.
I'm in keeping with my quiet nature. I just wanted to reflect that. I think that Senator Cruz is right in terms of what this does in terms of placement in statute, but I think that the concern that Director Coate raises is a good one. It speaks to the frame of mind that we have about this issue, and we should think about any other area of government where we think about raising an allocation and the types of accountability and outcomes that we're asking people to have. And as we move forward with this, I think we need to be thinking about that in the private market as well, rather than just panicking and saying, hey, we can't let the system collapse, so we have to do whatever the market demands. Mm-hmm. And I think that having this language, I've been part of this conversation, have done it myself, it raises the issue that the pressure on us is so great that we may be in danger of thinking about it in that way.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I think there's a suggestion of a couple of wording changes that you might want to include in the work session.
Wording changes, okay, we have two options. One option is to do the wording changes.
Mr. Chair,
but we would have to meet again to make them part of the bill before the 18th. The other option, which I think is the most reasonable one, is to do the wording changes and draft something and have that ready to go during February.
That's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
I'm getting nods from this end of the
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move LC 28 be introduced as a Senate committee bill.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves LC 28 be introduced as a committee bill. Do we have discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just briefly. There may be some word changes, but I would also suggest, because my sense is we will have an amendment in February, the reality is we need to get something that can be signed relatively soon. So we need to do that. But one of my suggestions would be relative to Section 1 that I think may render itself unnecessary is that the chair have a conversation with Senator Schrader and Ken Rocco, and if we have assurance that the rebalance is going to do what we think the rebalance is going to do, that we consider the removal of Section 1. That's just something to consider. Mm-hmm. Or at least some of the language in it. I mean, because quite honestly, Ms. Chair, the language is confusing, to say the least, as far as effective dates. But, and also when you look at the fact that Section 1 sunsets, the rest of the bill stays in place, I just think we need to, if we can serve the purpose we're trying to serve without it, okay. I'm always in favor of if things can work without the legislature having to make them work, we're better off. So,
okay, thank you for that suggestion. The director of the division said that he was also not happy with the language of Section 1. I mean, it's not that he wanted to tweak that language, and so there will be some work done on that, and we will follow your suggestion and see what kind of ensure. My last conversation with the Ways and Means, I had no assurances. I mean, and in fact, the idea is we're not going to make assurances at this point until we look at the big picture. And so that's interesting.
Well, Mr. Chair, my caveat is that we do have the assurances. My fear on one level is that with Section 1, there is fiscal. And I would just as soon, if we can get the rates adjusted without a fiscal on the bill, then the bill moves clean.
I understand. Thank you. That's a good suggestion. Okay. Further discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
Aye. Okay. The bill, the draft will pass to be drafted as a bill for the February session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.